This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Chris Gavaller is a novelist and educator, but we've asked him here today because he is also a scholar of superheroes. Not only does he teach college courses on the subject, he also pens the internationally recognized blog, modestly named the Patron Saint of Superheroes. Have a question about the true origins of a comic book character? A theory about their secret nature? Want to understand how some characters have changed as society has? Whether it's the political intentions of Wonder Woman's creator or the question that comes up most often about Batman, chances are what Chris Gavaller has uncovered will surprise you. On the golden anniversary of one of today's most popular superheroes, one created surely as an afterthought, originally intended for almost no lifespan at all, we dive deep into the stuff of legend right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Superheroes. Who's your favorite? How did he or she gain such a place of respect, honor, and affection with you? Or are you of the belief that even if they eventually graduated onto television screens and from there onto the big screen, no character who started life in a comic book should be worthy of our attention? They don't tell us anything about ourselves or our society. Well, this hour's guest might disagree with you on that last one, but whatever your view, you are invited to join this hour's conversation at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. It is indeed a pleasure to welcome back to the Inside Studios the author of the Patron Saint of Superheroes blog, Chris Gavaller. Chris, great to see you again.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be here.
So who's the biggest superhero in today's world, and how did they achieve that status?
The biggest. Okay. It depends on how you weigh that. I suppose if you're talking about money, which seems to be a way a lot of people like to weigh things at the moment, look at the box office. The Avengers, all-time biggest superhero moneymaker, Batman right behind it, Spider-Man behind that. So we've got, as far as money coming in, those are the big names. But if you step back a little bit further, I think if you did a general survey, Superman's going to come up almost number one every time, simply because he's the oldest, 1938. Not quite the very first superhero in comic books, but essentially the first, because he completely changed the comic book industry. Right behind him, Batman. Right behind Batman, Wonder Woman. And maybe vying for, you know, that bronze medal, you've got Spider-Man.
It actually, Republican primary debates earlier in the year, this question came up, and most everybody did say Superman was their favorite hero.
Yeah, there was actually a documentary I saw online. It was created by a 10-year-old. His father's a reporter, so I think, you know, dad helped. But he caught most of the Republicans and asked them that question, and almost every single one said Superman. I think that reveals more than anything else their age. The only Republican who said anything different was Rick Santorum. He was born in 1958. Most of them were born in the 40s. And he said Mr. Incredible from The Incredibles, and he sort of tied it to a family value thing. So I was fairly impressed that he was quick enough on his feet to give that answer. But almost everyone else just said Superman, except Ron Paul, who snubbed the 10-year-old and walked away.
Well, actually, this does tell us something about people, doesn't it?
It does indeed.
If they can talk about who their favorite superhero is, and then a follow-up question, and why. In politics a few years ago, a fellow by the name of Barack Obama.
I've heard of him, yes. Yeah. I think he picked, actually, you know, he split decision. He went with Batman and Spider-Man, but his answer was better than most, because he gave a pretty coherent reason. He saw, basically, he's anti-Superman. He sees Superman as getting his powers too easily, sort of a life of privilege, whereas Batman with the dead parents and Spider-Man, you know, that Uncle Ben, they get knocked around, he said. They have to sort of earn their superpowers, and he respects that. McCain actually was asked the same question, and he said Batman, but he didn't have as good a reason.
So this scholarship that you've been doing, Chris Cavallar, into superheroes got started about 4 years ago.
Yes.
We'll get into the story of how in a moment. But I'm curious, in the years of research that you've been doing since this got started, is there anything that has really surprised you?
There are several things that I would even say shocked me to the degree that I wasn't really sure how to write about them. If you go back to the earliest years, the earliest decades of the superhero, and a lot of people wouldn't even call these characters superheroes because they come before Superman in 1938, but the character type goes back all the way into Victorian age. We've got...
Before comic books.
Long, long before comic books. You've got pulp novels in the 1930s. They go back all the way into the Victorian tradition of the penny dreadfuls, and you've got a character called Springhill Jack, who essentially is Batman, or rather Batman is essentially him. He's jumping around in the 1870s.
So Springhill Jack.
Healed. He jumps.
Healed. Oh, I see. Springhill. This is very popular in Great Britain in these penny,
absolutely,
penny dreadfuls,
yes,
what the
yes.
novels were called. There are stories about this superhero that say what?
Well, the main character was his fortunes were robbed. He's, you know, like I said, like Bruce Wayne, like Batman. His money's been seized by an evil relative, and so he disguises himself as the devil, and he's got this magic boot. It's been manufactured by his Indian mentor. He grew up in India. And he literally jumps around, and he's terrorizing the lawyer and his cousin who's stolen his money, and he does this until he's able to regain his inheritance. And as he's doing that, he's also helping other people too. So it's really the superhero formula right from the beginning.
Well, we still have to ask you the most common question that you get about Batman, and what some people are going to think of is fairly bizarre political and even sexual agenda of the creator of Wonder Woman. But I want to remind anybody who's listening that you are welcome to join this conversation with novelist, blogger, and visiting professor of English at Washington and Lee University, Chris Cavallar. Phone number is 888-WMRA-TALK in all numbers. That's 888-967-2825. Or you can reach us through Facebook, where we are listed, interestingly enough, as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And here on Facebook, we have this question for you, Chris. This is from Serene, who says, "My children are obsessed with superheroes. I'd like to hear the guests' research on several comic book superstars, especially my son's favorites, Captain America and Batman, my daughter's favorite, Ant-Man, and my own guilty pleasure, Iron Man."
Well, that's a great list. Tom, pick one of those four and I'll run with it.
Ant-Man.
Oh, I knew you were going to pick that. Okay. Ant-Man is an early Marvel character, one of Stan Lee's first attempts at creating a superhero. The thing to remember about Stan Lee is he was both probably the most important innovator, but he's also kind of a jerk. Sorry, Stan. But he was really a bit of a thief as far as stealing ideas for superheroes from ones that pre-existed. But he added a tremendous amount to the genre at the same time. Ant-Man, not one of his shiningest moments, but it's kind of revealing because Lee did not like superheroes. He said that explicitly. He was about to quit writing comic books entirely when the superheroes resurged in the early 1960s, and his boss told him he had to start creating superheroes. He didn't really want to. The character of Ant-Man is actually a 1950s style sci-fi story. He was just this scientist who accidentally shrunk himself and had a horrible adventure in an anthill, and it was just a one-off story. But then when Lee was forced to come up with ideas for superheroes, he dragged this poor guy out of the closet and put a costume on him and called him Ant-Man.
He stole it. Basically.
Well, that one, I would say, was a little more legitimate. He had written that original story. I guess I'm really referring to almost every other character he created, as far as the superpowers, they all preexisted. He was not a great innovator for superpowers by any extent.
I got to confess ignorance here, and this is why I'm really hoping that people are going to start calling in and sharing their perspective on this. I did not read comic books as a kid. I don't have a clue who Ant-Man was. What were his powers?
He could turn very, very small. So just about it. But he somehow retained his strength. And later he could talk to ants and they would do things for him. He's sort of like the Aquaman of insects. He can talk to the bugs. Not, again, one of the greatest moments in superhero history there.
Well, but, let's give Serene another shot at these four that she lists. How about her guilty pleasure, Iron Man?
Iron Man's interesting almost because of, more than anything else, it's politics. Stan Lee, he'd been creating superheroes for a couple years.
This is another Stan Lee creation?
This is another Stan Lee creation. Basically, all of the characters other than DC's big three are going to be characters connected to Marvel, to Stan Lee.
So there's DC Comics and Marvel.
Exactly.
At least since the 1960s, the two biggies.
Right, and they're still the two biggest. Together they own two-thirds of the comic book market, though the comic book market has shrunk to almost nothing. So Stan Lee created Iron Man. And his characters like Spider-Man and the Hulk and the Fantastic Four had taken on a counterculture feel. They were very connected to the liberal movement of the 1960s. He created Iron Man as a sort of a push back against that. Iron Man's a very conservative character. He's an industrialist. He's a very pro-war. And Lee was sort of playing around to see what how he could, you know, jerk his audience around a little bit. He was creating a character that went against what was selling as far as the other Marvel characters. He also, again, stole everything from previous people. There was a 1940s comic book called Bozo the Iron Man, and it's a terrible name, but I'm glad he got rid of the Bozo, but the Iron Man stood. And as far as the idea of putting on a mechanical metal suit, that Harry Houdini fought a supervillain called the Automaton in 1920. So Lee is just grabbing the stuff from the cupboard and recycling it.
Lexington, Virginia-based writer Chris Gavaller is our guest. In addition to a variety of novels, short stories, and scholarly articles, he is also author of the online blog called The Patron Saint of Superheroes. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. In terms of politics and comic book starts for big-time characters, what some would call the biggest of all, Superman, has very much a political origin story?
Well, it depends on what you mean by political. When I went back and looked at the social context for Superman, and this is really what I try to do, I sort of see, looking at these characters, it's a kind of cultural archaeology. I'm sort of digging in a pit and seeing where these things came from. And Superman, I assume a lot of people have heard of Nietzsche's Superman, and also the eugenics movement used the term Superman. Now, a lot of people assume that when Jerry Siegel, the creator, the writer of Superman, came up with that name, they assume that there's no connection, and that's not the case whatsoever. Jerry Siegel very much had the idea of German fascism in mind, and the Superman was the ideal of the Aryan nation state. They were trying to create a race of supermen. I mean, explicitly this terminology of Aryans, and anyone who's not an Aryan is inferior and really needs to be weeded out. Most specifically for Jerry Siegel, Jews, because he was Jewish, like his co-creator Joe Shuster. So when they chose the name Superman for a hero, that was a radical choice. They were saying they grabbed away from Hitler's poster boy, the Superman, and said, nope, we're going to take him and we're going to make him fight fascism instead of being a tool of fascism. It was a radical choice. And people sort of lose that historical context and don't realize the word Superman doesn't start with the comic book character. In fact, it was a very strange choice because it was extremely well-known name. If you plug in the word Superman into a database like for the New York Times archives, you'll get thousands and thousands of hits. Everyone was called a Superman. It was one of the most common terms possible. So it was a strangely generic term for Siegel to grab, and he grabbed it for political reasons.
And long before Christopher Reeves would bring the character back to life on the big screen, in his earliest days, Superman was there to fight against the Nazis.
Absolutely. And he was fighting...
I'm sorry, we're going to hit the break in just a moment. I want to remind the audience that this bizarre... Well, maybe I shouldn't characterize it that way. I'll let you judge when you hear about what the creator of Wonder Woman had in mind when we get back. One of Chris Gavaller's novels is a bit of historical fiction that touches upon the life of a real-world superhero. Titled School for Tricksters, it's about the Carlisle Indian School in Pennsylvania back in the days when athlete Jim Thorpe was a student there. But we are focused this hour on another one of Chris's passions, the role of comic book superheroes in our society. Chris Gavaller teaches about superheroes as a visiting professor at Washington and Lee. He's written a number of scholarly articles on the topic, and he also publishes the online blog titled The Patron Saint of Superheroes. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Before we get to Wonder Woman, you had a little bit more you wanted to say about fascism and Superman, Chris?
Certainly. And it's interesting that you mentioned Jim Thorpe there, because this is around 1915, in that time period. One of the biggest influences on the American superhero genre is, and I find it's quite disturbing to even say out loud, the KKK. The Klan is a prototype for the superhero. They wear costumes. They have a symbol on their chest. They have dual identity. They have secret code names. When I sort of stumbled across this, I was disturbed. I didn't know quite what to do with it, but I've been researching it and trying to explore it further, and I find it quite fascinating and revealing that the earliest superheroes are very reactionary, very conservative, very against what later superheroes would stand for, like Superman. One of Superman's first adventures is to prevent the lynching of a man who's been pulled out of a jail cell. So Siegel, again, just like with fascism, he's taking these pre-existing ideas and twisting them backwards and creating a new kind of hero.
But there was this character that you write about in one of your articles, Thomas Dixon, was it?
Thomas Dixon is the author of The Klansman, which was the source novel that became the notorious film Birth of a Nation.
And in his novel, and which was very popular.
It was huge.
At the time, it's Southerners fighting back against the evil Negro
exactly.
by dressing up in costume and
exactly.
becoming superheroes and rescuing the poor white people.
Exactly. And that novel was huge, and then it got even more expanded to a larger audience when D.W. Griffith turned into the film Birth of a Nation in, I think, 1915. In fact, the film was so influential, the Klan, which had not existed for decades, was reformed, and the Klan became millions of people joined the Klan nationwide. And the Klan was seen as a positive thing, much like later superheroes. The idea of that the law system is insufficient, we need vigilantes, masked vigilantes, to take the law into their own hands in order to make society better. That's the ethos that the superhero inherits later, though politically writers reverse what it was that the characters are fighting against, but the formula is the same.
Superhero scholarly researcher, I don't know if I did the grammar right, because that makes him sound like he's a superhero, but maybe he is. Chris Gavaller is our guest. 888-WMRA-TALK, how to reach us by phone. Steve from Philadelphia, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment, please.
Hi.
Hi.
I read comics pretty religiously from around 56 to 62, 63, particularly in the Superboy, Superman series. And
yes.
I remember six comic titles, and I want to see if you have any sense of the difference between them or what the evolution of those comics might have suggested.
Okay.
It was Superman, Superboy, Action Comics, Adventure Comics, if I'm not mistaken, Lois Lane, and I think Jimmy Olsen had his own comic.
He did.
And then later came Supergirl. Was there anything significant in how those evolved?
Well, what's going on is that the superhero in the 1950s has almost completely died out. There were only three that continued through all the 50s, and that was Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman. And so DC Comics is trying to just keep alive the brand as much as possible, and so exploiting it by creating as many Superman-themed, connected comic books as possible. What's interesting, though, is Superboy particularly was the breaking point for when Siegel and Schuster, the original creators, were kicked out of DC. They no longer had anything to do with the characters, and the fight started over Superboy when they wanted to create that character, and DC originally didn't want anything to do with it. But eventually DC just took over everything. So DC, with all these titles, are just trying to capitalize on this world they've created. Now, because superhero...
And when you say DC, just for the sake of...
absolutely. Detective Comics. But they're now just...
DC Comics is what you're talking about.
Okay. That's exactly what I'm talking about. What's happened in the 1950s is that the old school superhero of World War II, the Nazi bashers, no longer were popular. That's why most characters died out. So to keep the character going, they had to change how the character was presented. So, for instance, the reason Lois Lane got her own comic book is because it became more focused on romance, for instance. The old school World War II superhero who's always battling bad guys, that died out a little bit in the 50s. So the rise of those other comic books reflects that. And Superboy, going back to his youth, again, that's not about him beating up Nazis anymore. It really changes the focus away from what I was talking about before, fascism. People were sick of fascism. They didn't want to hear about fascism. Tell us about romance and, you know, little kids in costumes.
Steve, thanks so much for the great questions. Chris Cavaller, I got to get you to tell me about Wonder Woman and sexual domination and women's power to keep men in line.
All right. We're talking about William Marston, the creator of Wonder Woman.
Who's actually a psychiatrist?
He was indeed. And a rather strange one. A psychologist, actually, not a MD. He created the character of Wonder Woman with a very specific reason. He had a social agenda, and he was using Wonder Woman to try to push it forward. Now, it's a little hard to believe, but I'm going to try to summarize it. He thought the way to, you know, world peace, basically, this is during World War II, the way to get to a happy, peaceful society was literally through sexual bondage. He believed that a good citizen was a person who knew how to enjoy having his will to
subjugate it.
Exactly. You know, I'm sort of twisting over these words because I can't actually believe I'm saying this on the radio. Yes, sexual bondage will save the universe. If you learn to enjoy to be tied up by someone who loves you, you will experience that as pleasure, and you will then be able to have your will submitted to other people like the law, the police, government, whatever.
So there would no longer be violence.
Exactly.
Because disobedience.
Exactly, because you would find it pleasurable to be obedient.
And do we still see those strains of bondage in Wonder Woman today?
Wonder Woman has never escaped from that history. That magic lasso that she carries, it's always seems to be in the plots. And someone, you know, usually she's the one getting tied up. Now, that's the problem. Marston claimed that he was trying to teach his boy readers how to have their will, you know, to submit their wills to alluring women, as he called them. The problem is that though that was his intention, if you look at even his own comics that he wrote for Wonder Woman, it's Wonder Woman who's always getting tied up. So the character and the intent never quite fit. And in fact, after Wonder Woman, there were many female superhero characters who would get tied up on the covers of their comic books every week. And it was clearly not about changing the world for the good.
Novelist, blogger, and visiting professor of English at Washington and Lee University, Chris Cavaller is our guest. 888-967-2825, our phone number. Next to Basie, Greg, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment, please.
Yeah, thanks. After that last question, I think mine kind of pales in comparison. But in the book by Michael Chabon, The Cavalier and Clay,
yes,
he's got this sort of fictionalized origin of a Superman-like hero being,
yes,
from the Golem, sort of the Jewish, kind of like the Hulk of the Jewish ghetto. And I was wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, Chabon's character was called The Escapist, if I recall. And this is a novel that won the Pulitzer back in 2000 and really sort of made superheroes legitimate as far as highbrow art. So his character, Chabon, through the whole novel, is really exploring the Jewish background to the superhero, which is huge. A majority of superhero creators were Jewish, both writers and artists, Siegel and Schuster being the primary examples. And his novel is a fictionalized version of that partnership and really a love triangle. And the figure of the golem plays through the entire novel. Chabon doesn't really look at the character as a Hulk character. He's more interested in the escapist, who's a, more like Batman or Superman along those lines. But I think it was Stan Lee who in the early 60s really picked up that Gollum or Frankenstein idea with the Hulk, with the Thing, and arguably you could trace that back to the Gollum.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Greg, thank you for calling in. 888-967-2825. Translates to 888-WMRA-TALK, if it's easier for you to remember that way. If you'd like to talk with researcher of superheroes, Chris Gavaller. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Let's talk a little bit about this big 50th anniversary of someone who's seen, I would think, as a pretty huge superhero today, but as far as original intentions were concerned, never should have become thus.
Indeed. We're talking Spider-Man, I assume. And that's correct. Spider-Man was supposed to be a one-off issue of a magazine that was being that was defunct. It was its final issue. And Martin Goodman decided, that's the publisher of Marvel, decided, okay, let's get rid of this ridiculous character that Stan Lee and Steve Ditko dreamed up. We'll just throw him into this magazine. That'll be the end of it. But then the magazine, which had been, plummeting, suddenly sold out. And Martin Goodman had the brilliant idea of, well, let's start a new magazine just focused on Spider-Man. So it should have been just a one-off, and instead it became one of the most important comic books in comic book history.
Well, let's give away a few family secrets here, if we could, Chris, because what I recall from what I've read of your writing and in talking to you before, Martin Goodman got this youngster by the name of Stan Lee.
Actually, he was named Stanley Lieber at the time. He changed his name later.
Who was about 16 or 17 at
exactly,
the time?
Exactly, and this is late 30s, early 40s.
And there was some nepotism involved.
Indeed. Basically, his aunt got him the job. It was
Stan Lee's.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So
because she was married to the guy who ran Marvel Comics.
Exactly.
Martin
so,
Goodman.
So give my little teenager a job. And so at first, Stan Lee is just the office boy. He's getting lunch for the artist. He's proofreading. He's erasing stray pencil marks on the art boards. He's at the bottom of the hierarchy. But then when the staff got shooken up and some people left, Stanley was the last man or last boy standing, and he found himself at the editor's desk, and he never left it. He took over Marvel.
But before that, even he
became the interim editor of what was then called Timely Comics. I think as early as 1943.
So when did he and his colleague, who wrote the first episode of Spider-Man,
1962,
and was Stan Lee still a teenager then, or had he graduated?
No,
to
he had aged.
But
superheroes
still,
don't age, but Stanley did age.
Is it true that Stan and his collaborator, whose name I'm struggling for,
Steve Ditko.
Okay, Steve Ditko. They created Spider-Man just as sort of this afterthought, and had this one-time publication with their boss, Martin Goodman, thinking, this will never go anywhere.
Exactly.
I'm doing this just because he's my wife's nephew and I got to do him a favor.
Well, no, the favor was giving him the job back in 10, 20 years before that. At this point, Goodman is turning to Lee to write all of the comics, and Lee is just cranking them out. In fact, he's barely writing them. He had this system, they called it the Marvel Method, which is a silly way of describing it because it makes it sound rather grandiose. All he did was he simply would sit down with one of his artists and quickly describe an idea for a comic book story, and then the artist's job was to go draw it, but leave all the talk bubbles empty. And then Stanley would come in later and scribble in the dialogue. So it was the easiest way for Stanley to do his job. But with Spider-Man, the reason I thought that it was just going to be a one-off story is that the character broke so many of the rules of what a superhero was supposed to be back in 1962. There's well, first of all, he's only 15, and the, you know, sidekicks are supposed to be that young, not the official superhero. And the guy, he had bad luck. You know, the secret, you know, world of superheroes, the secret rule is that things always work out for the superhero. You know, the universe just sort of works in their favor. Just, you know, the plots always turn that way. But sometimes things would go badly for Spider-Man, and that was a shocking new idea. And most importantly, Peter Parker was kind of a jerk. The original character, the original story is really a morality tale. This teenager, he seems like a perfectly nice guy to start with, gets superpowers, and probably like most kids or adults, sort of it goes straight to his head, and he's just interested in taking care of himself. And because of that, you know, his uncle dies, he learns his horrible lesson. And because of that, he suddenly has a motivation for, you know, becoming a real superhero. But he started out flawed.
So we are talking about anything and everything to do with superheroes here on this edition of Virginia Insight with our guest researcher, Chris Gavaller. You who are listening, do you have a favorite superhero? Do you have a theory about why that person or entity is your superhero? Has it changed over the years? Can you look back in your childhood and say, yeah, that's why they were my superhero then, and this is why? If you're willing to share any of that with us, or if you have a question for Chris, we'd love to hear from you at 888-967-2825. Or you can post to us on the Virginia Insight Facebook page, which is what Carolyn did. And in response to a question that we had put up on Facebook, Chris, Carolyn says, the question was, who's your favorite superhero? She says Spider-Man.
Yes.
I love the whole accidental genetic engineering thing.
Yeah, the accident is kind of interesting. The idea that so many of these superheroes are being transformed by some fluke. It's rarely planned. You know, the accidental spider bite, the, you know, even Superman, his planet explodes. There's always some kind of catastrophe going on. And from the catastrophe, the superhero is born. That's always been part of the imagined world. And I think Marvel in the early 60s, Stan Lee, really pushed that idea even further so that these accidents, they tend to actually be horrible accidents. It's, you know, bad things happen to these characters, and sort of to make things better, they become superheroes. And so it's not a perfect world that they inhabit anymore. The characters from from World War II, from the 1940s, they were very simple. They were pure good guys fighting pure bad guys, and things always worked out for them. When Stan Lee took over superheroes, and again, he disliked them. And one of the reasons I think he disliked them is because they didn't make any psychological sense. And so he gave them real psychological motivation. And some of them are deeply flawed. Some of them are outright despicable. The original character of the Hulk was a bad guy. He wasn't trying to help anyone. He was actually a kind of supervillain. He was a Frankenstein creature run amok. He was based on the character of the Thing, who evolved into a lovable character. But Stan Lee's original plan for the Thing was he was a supervillain. He was a monster who was just by accident working with the other members of the Fantastic Four. He didn't believe in being a superhero. He was just stuck there.
It sounds like what you're saying is that as of the early 60s with Spider-Man and the characters that followed, the psychological complexity of the
yes.
characters really appealed to people. Did that say something about changes in our society?
Very much. You know, with again, going back to World War II, culturally, we were not interested in hearing complicated stories about good and bad. We wanted things to be simple. But the Cold War, and that's the background, you know, to these early Marvel characters, was much more complicated. And rather than waging war, America was terrified of war. We were...
So the obvious follow-up is, do you think we're going back towards simple characters, but we have to wait for the break to get your answer? We continue here on Virginia Insight in just about 1 minute. Novelist, blogger, and visiting professor of English at Washington and Lee University, Chris Gavaller is our guest. I'm Tom Graham. This is Virginia Insight. Phone number 888-WMRA-TALK. Or if you're a little bit shy and you'd rather type instead of talk, you can post a question or comment to us on our Facebook page, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Do you see trends that say something about our society today based on the superheroes that are most popular today? Are we going back to this yearning for simpler times?
I think there's that yearning is always something that's in the superhero formula. When you see these characters being recycled into film, I'm thinking particularly of the most recent Batman movie, there is this undertow of, wouldn't it be nice if the world were simple, if there were simple bad guys, simple good guys, and we could just know what was what. But the history of the comic book is not moving in that direction at all. You've got the simplest characters in World War II. The Cold War produced this ambivalence toward war. We were terrified of wiping out human life on the planet. So the characters from the early 60s, they are not simple superheroes because the social political context was not simple. These characters were part monsters. They were sort of they were like nuclear deterrents. We need them. They protect us. But they're kind of monstrous, and if they lose control, they'll destroy us all. That became the model of the 1960s superhero. The 1970s superhero became even more complicated. With the end of the Vietnam War, suddenly American society is seeing, understanding what exactly it means to fight a war, and seeing American soldiers, good-hearted American soldiers who committed atrocities in the name of their the United States. And so the superhero, particularly Marvel again, they created heroes that were clearly even more monstrous than the Thing or the Hulk. You've got characters like the Punisher, who has a skull on his chest and murders bad guys. You've got a character like Deathlok, who is a zombie cyborg super soldier, sort of a complete rewrite of the Captain America world. Or Wolverine. I remember being very confused when Wolverine came out because he's got blade sticking out of his fist. And I remember, I was a little kid and I'm thinking, well, how does he punch anyone? Oh, you can't punch anyone with blades sticking out of your head. And I couldn't even get my head around it. Or characters like Blade, who is a vampire, or the Ghost Rider, who's literally a demon. He's got a flaming skull for a head. These are very different kinds of characters, much darker, much uglier, much more ambivalent, not the simple good guy versus, or bad guy versus good guy anymore.
And you see this as largely an influence of Vietnam?
At that moment, yeah, around 1973, 1974, all of these characters I just named all just surge into the Marvel pantheon.
So what about today?
Well, today, it's a very different kind of world because you have to understand comic books, they're not extinct, but they are no longer the center of superhero genre. It's the films, and the comic books are really minor league. So whereas for decades, these characters and these ideas would evolve in the comic books and slowly filter out into other areas of culture, that's not the case anymore. So we no longer have that sort of test tube creation that we had for decades. So now everything is about the films, and the films are really all over the place. You can take The Avengers, for instance. I liked it. It's a good film. It is complicated if you try to break it down as far as what is its social or political context. What's it really trying to say? It's very nostalgic for World War II. Captain America ends up being the main character, and it's about trying to find a way to unify against an enemy. But without the enemy, they all really kind of fall apart. It's sort of a nostalgia for Hitler, love to hate you letter. We really, we want, it seems, to have a clean bad guy so we can unify against him. The comic book, or rather the superhero genre, is all about that.
The question most often asked about Batman.
Indeed. Is he gay? Or rather, is Robin gay? Or did Robin and Batman sleep together?
This dates back to like the 1950s?
Absolutely. There was another psychologist, not quite as insane as William Marston, but Frederick Wortham, was one of the first people to look at Batman and Robin and say, clearly, these two are gay. And he objected to it deeply. And he has a book called The Seduction of the Innocent. and it was a huge bestseller. It actually caused Senate hearings about whether comic books are causing juvenile delinquency. As a result, the comic book industry had to create the Comics Code.
And is this a little bit like, is SpongeBob SquarePants gay, or are Sesame Street characters gay? Or?
No, it is different, because you can make a legitimate argument that, yes, Batman and Robin were gay. It's not, I don't think you can make an argument that it was the intention of the creators to do that. For instance, Bob Kane was the artist. His writer, Bill Finger, simply said, you know, Batman to talk to, because it's hard to write these stories if there's no dialogue. He didn't say, I need someone for Batman to cuddle with. He just wanted, you know, a Watson character. And Bob Kane, having done this sidekick formula with an earlier cartoon, created Robin. And so after that, Robin was so popular, suddenly all of these kid sidekicks are all over the comics. And
but what makes it look like in the comic strips that there's a sexual relationship between Batman and Robin?
Well, there's a couple particularly funny images of Bruce and Robin getting out of bed together. And it was, I think it was intended quite innocently, that it's a father-son relationship. He's his ward. And I do not believe Bob Kane intended a sexual undertone. But what happened, and this actually
wasn't there also something about some of the detractors in the 1950s talking about how well-dressed they were, so they must be gay?
That was in there, too. Once they decided this was the fact, they looked for any kind of evidence they could possibly find, and that was on the list. Because, of course, Bruce has quite a income, and he can spend as much money on clothes as he wants. But I don't think that was the core of it. What's happening is that Batman is, again, a character that so many of these characters are just knockoffs of earlier characters. So in the 1930s, you had a lot of mystery men who were basically Batman, and they had helpmates. They had they had fiancés. Like the Shadow had Margot Lane, and the Spider had, I forget her name, but you've got all these fiancés who are helping out their superhero boyfriends. And when Bob Kane created Robin, without, I think, really thinking about it, Robin replaces the fiancé character. So there was always this sexual innuendo in these earlier characters, and Robin and Batman accidentally stepped into that same space. And I think that's why people kept reading in the sexuality.
Lexington, Virginia-based writer Chris Gavaller is our guest. In addition to a variety of novels, short stories, and scholarly articles, he is also author of the online blog called The Patron Saint of Superheroes. We've got just a few minutes left to fit in more calls. If you have a question, comment, theory about superheroes you'd be willing to share with us, we've got a phone line open for you at 888-WMRA-TALK. Gene, thanks for using that number. Your question or comment, please.
Oh, did we lose Gene?
Hello?
Hello, Gene.
You're on the air, sir.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Do you consider the cowboys back in the early 30s superheroes, such as Tom Mix?
Oh, sure. They've definitely played into that.
I mean, that seemed like we would look up to kind of the cowboys because they were always the good people, and there were several cowboys in those days.
Absolutely. And the cowboy and the superhero, those two character types grew side by side, and they went back and forth. In fact, you know, we've been talking a lot about Stan Lee in the early 60s. He wrote almost as many cowboy stories as he was writing superhero stories simultaneously. So he certainly saw the two character types as sort of overlapping. And, of course, the whole vigilante idea that the superhero inherits, that comes from the Western. You know, cowboys out on the frontier where the law is not really in control, so you need a vigilante to take care of things. That idea comes from the Western. That's a cowboy concept, and the superhero really just grabs it from the cowboy. So the two characters are definitely overlapping.
Gene, thanks so much for your call. Reminds me that in some of your scholarly work, I think, Chris, you point out that heroes of radio drama days actually predated the superheroes that showed up in comic books, because comic books really didn't take off till the late 1930s?
That's right. 1938 is when things started to boom, 1939 really. Before that, radio was the home of superheroes. You have The Shadow was by far the most significant, but you also had, well, here's a, this speaks to what Gene just asked, The Lone Ranger is the perfect combination of cowboy and superhero, the masked, you know, he was a masked man. That was, you know, clearly a superhero motif. And these were all over the radio. The Green Hornet. Actually, he's supposed to be the great great grandnephew of the Lone Ranger. So radio was really the home of the superhero, and so was the pulp magazine. Comic books were sort of this, you know, the pulp of the pulp, sort of the absolute lowest bottom, worst kind of magazine that could possibly be made, and that's where the superhero crawled out of. So it's really from other media that they got their start.
Robert in Lexington, thanks for joining us. You're on the air on Virginia Insight with Chris Cavaller.
Yes, hi. I'm curious about some of the alternative comics, I guess, of the late 80s and 90s, like the Dark Horse label with Flaming Carrot. Flaming Milkman, and where do they fit in your...
Well, what's interesting is that comics really started changing in the 1980s. Like I was saying before, like after the Vietnam War, characters get much darker. That happened to an even greater degree in the 80s with Frank Miller's Dark Knight or the Alan Moore's The Watchmen. And what's happening simultaneously is that Marvel and DC had an almost complete monopoly of superheroes and comic books. That monopoly breaks down a little bit because creators are demanding rights. They're arguing that we are making these characters, we deserve to have more of the profits instead of just handing everything over. I think Siegel and Shuster, what they got from Superman was $130 for the concept, and then they were paid by issue after that. So Dark Horse was a... is a continuing publishing house that was created in the early 80s, and so was Image, I think, in the early 90s. These are comic book companies that are fighting against Marvel and DC, and so they're creating a much wider range of characters. Things are a little crazier on the periphery, and so you get things like Flaming Carrot, who's a great character. You get things like Cerebus at that same time, a whole range of characters who are really opposed to Marvel, DC controlling everything.
Do you think that the absurdity there with those characters reflects anything going on culturally? Because they were really much more absurd than the classic superhero, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely, much more absurd. I think that absurdity had been in comics for a while, particularly the 1960s underground movement, and it had just sort of dipped under for a while, so it was actually a return to what was going on a couple decades earlier. That at least would be my argument. What I see going on primarily in the 1980s and early 90s is the, again, if you go back to Dark Knight and Watchmen, you've got the end of the Cold War, and so with the dissolution of the Soviet Union, suddenly all of these Soviet themes are playing all over comic books, and I think it helped change the whole flavor of comic books. Again, things get much darker. Suddenly, we're even further away from the unifying element of Adolf Hitler. So we don't even have the evil empire to fight against anymore. And then suddenly superheroes are fighting against each other.
Robert, thanks so much for your call. We have this question coming in on Facebook from Nancy, and we should point out, Chris Cavaller, that you are not a psychologist. You're a novelist and an English professor who's taken on this role of researching superheroes. But she says, I'm curious if the guest has done any research on the role of superhero mimicry in child development, especially gender identity.
Wow. Fascinating concept. No, I have not done any research directly on that, though I can say only from personal experience, it was fascinating watching my daughter grow up with the world of superheroes. Now, probably it sounds like I'm so obsessed with superheroes that I just inundated her with all this stuff. But
well, your wife kind of thinks so, doesn't she?
Indeed. She told me that I can only talk about superheroes for 5 minutes per day, and then I get cut off. But I swear it actually worked the opposite direction with my daughter. This is before I started teaching this course, before I got interested in all this research. And my daughter got interested in superheroes from something she saw on TV. And then so I bought her a Superman comic book. And then all of my interest really was because she got so interested in the Justice League and Wonder Woman and Batman and Superman. And frankly, I was a Marvel kid growing up. I had no interest in those
characters.
But
there are not a lot of female superheroes.
There are not. And Wonder Woman, as we've already discussed, is quite a complicated character and not the best role model, though I think she has evolved into a much stronger one. But so many of the superheroines are so absurdly sexualized. In fact, I don't think, for the most part, children should be reading comic books. They're not designed for them anymore. You know, World War II comics, the average age was about 12. When Stan Lee starts writing in the 60s, suddenly college students start getting interested in comic books. And since the 90s and currently, the average age for a comic book reader is 25. That's not kid stuff. And if you open some of these, they're extremely violent, they're extremely sexualized, and they're not stuff you should be handing to your kids.
So we got about 30 seconds left. In that amount of time, if you can, please, please tell us what's happening to Lois Lane.
Well, what are you referring to right now?
Well, there's rumor that Superman is leaving her for Wonder Woman.
Well, they broke them up last year. In fact, they rebooted their entire universe just so they wouldn't have to divorce the two characters. So instead of like having them break up, they decided, let's start the whole universe over. And they renumbered all of their comics at DC. So they all start with number one. And so Lois and Clark had never actually been together at all. So it's not a divorce.
But they got married in the 1990s.
They did, but they've...
Now in one universe, they're together, and in another universe, Superman is with Wonder Woman?
Every 15 years, DC erases the past and rewrites everything. And so right now, Lois and Clark are not together. But you know what? I think they'll be back together again. Don't worry.
Our guest has been Chris Gavaller, visiting professor of English at Washington and Lee University, author of the historical novel School for Tricksters, and creator of the online blog The Patron Saints of Superheroes. Chris, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Tom.
Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producers, Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jospe and Inner Rhythm. You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. If you go to that page, you'll find links to more information about the work that Mr. Gavaller is doing, including a link to his online blog. Thanks for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.